that's good. Yep. A little something different this morning.
Yeah.
Little no sniffle, a little string Led Zeppelin. There you go. Anyway, this is Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Warren, along with Josh. And program heard most Fridays here on MSO. Spread the word. What you got this morning?
Well, this morning we have Amy George, who's the Director of Clinical Outreach for a company here in that has many satellites around the country, but a location here in Massachusetts. Second guest is Stan Yusevich, a former mayor of Salem. He has a position with Verizon now, but he was Community Development Director here in Gloucester years ago. And our third guest is Genevieve Knave, who's the founder at the Center for Therapy and Healing.
Okay, sounds good. We'll be back with all that more in just a minute.
Sunday brunch at the Gloucester House. The brunch includes Gloucester House baked haddock, grilled beef tips, fruit-filled crepes, chicken, potatoes, and much, much more. Sundays from 10 to 2. $20 for adults, $12 for children. The Gloucester House, on the water at 63 Roger Street in Gloucester. Owner Lenny Linquata.
This is the freshest seafood you can get, from our boats to your plate.
Hi folks, this is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Amy George, who's the Director of Clinical Outreach for the Sunspire Health Spring Hill. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we usually start out, tell us your bio, your background, a little bit about yourself, and then we can get some discussion of the good work your organization does.
Sure. Well, I've worked in the field for a number of years. I started out in mental health right out of college and subsequently found myself working in the addiction field. And it was something that I didn't know a ton about, but really have developed, you know, if I could say a love for it, you know, a passion. It's, you know, amazing what families are going through every day. And it's really inspired me, and I have three young children of my own, two daughters and a son. And, you know, I think what I've realized most through this process is that it could very easily be me involved in a situation regarding my family members with addiction. And, you know, it hits close to home when you have a family and you're raising a family and you're trying to do the right things, and what you realize is that this is impacting everyone and anyone. It touches so many lives. And, you know, so being a part of helping to find people the services that they need and supporting these families has been an amazing opportunity for me. So it's been great.
Great. Now, my parents grew up during the Depression, so you didn't, you know, in their era, you didn't hear much about addiction. People had their issues, but it wasn't on the front page, if you will.
Right.
Today,
right.
It's much more prevalent, and I'm not suggesting that anything has changed in a generation, other than that we've confronted it and brought it out into the open more. I don't think it's.
Absolutely.
But addiction hits. If you went into a our club meeting, Rotary, the Elks, whatever, and said, how many people, either someone in your family or someone you know, has been afflicted with addiction? Everybody most everybody would raise their hand. They know somebody or whatever, and yet addiction hits in so many places. It's not just alcohol or drugs, but people are addicted to many kinds of things. What are some of the things people are addicted to, and What are some of the things that your organization does to help them?
So, you know, since working at, you know, Spring Hill, I see individuals that are dealing with many different types of addiction. You know, right now, obviously, there's a lot of information out there about opiate abuse and opiate use, and, you know, that's very prevalent. You know, I'm seeing that on a daily basis. You know, unfortunately, in the world around us, we're seeing a lot of overdoses, and that's very real. You know, this is occurring with, you know, women that are age 25 that maybe have their master's degrees that are now addicted to heroin. I'm seeing, you know, the average person, you know, the child that came from a very well-structured family that has unfortunately fallen, you know, into this this lifestyle, and you know, it's devastating. You know, the thing is too, I also still see a lot of alcoholism. I mean, I think we can't forget that alcoholism, you know, is a very, you know, powerful addiction that people deal with every day. You know, but we're also seeing people that are getting addicted to prescribed medications, you know, medications for anxiety, you know, such as Ativan. We're also, you know, seeing people that have co-occurring addictions, you know, maybe dealing with eating disorders as well as, you know, maybe sex addiction or, you know, gambling addiction. So, you know, it can go in many different directions. And to be honest with you, we see it all.
Yeah. What, and the kinds of, treatment or programs that are, available for people, what are they, and tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, typically if I get a call from a family member or an individual looking for service, often the first place that we go is detox. You know, that's a place where they can get stabilized, get all the drugs out of their system. You know, usually they're medically supervised, they're assisted through this process. It's never anything that you want to do alone. There's a lot of risk to detoxing, especially with alcohol. And, you know, it really should be something that's monitored medically by professionals. So, you know, first spot is usually we facilitate detox. And then, you know, the next level of care is residential. And, you know, we really feel strongly that, you know, staying in a treatment facility for as long as you can, you know, is very advisable. When you're in treatment, you're learning a new language. You're learning the language of recovery. You're just starting to feel better. And it's not uncommon, you know, around about day 11 that individuals say, yeah, I feel really good. I think I'm done. And what we know is that the longer you stay in treatment, you know, we see higher success rates. And that's not always easy to do. I mean, obviously there's financial factors, there's insurance factors, but we really work very hard to keep people in our program for a full 30 days, and then help them to coordinate along with their family the next level of care, which is usually a structured sober living environment, where they're being able to practice those skills out in the community. I mean, the reality is you have to live your life in recovery. You know, I often say you almost have to go into, you know, you have to change your identity, change who you are. You have to live a different life after you go into treatment. And that sometimes involves changing your friends, coming off of social media. You have to reinvent yourself. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there in recovery that are living their lives, having a great time, and maybe they never expected that it could be that way. But I see a lot of people that are living very successfully in recovery. So, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, the people that, you know, are passing away because of overdose and, you know, and that is very real. But on the flip side of that, I also see a lot of hope. I see a lot of people that are leading productive, very, very successful lives in recovery. But they're working at it every day. You know, you can't get complacent. It's a part of your life, you know, once you're at that point.
Okay. Now, you said about changing your friend structure or reinventing yourself. And at one point you said maybe even coming off social media. What role does social media play in all of this?
Well, you know, I think social media, you know, it actually does have its positives too. You know, I see a huge network on social media of people that are in recovery, that are there to support others in recovery, and that's amazing. But, you know, we can all fall, you know, there's pitfalls with social media.
Sure.
You know, there are things that can be very triggering that are online. You know, you have people that are able to access you 24/7 when you have your cell phone, when you're on social media. And unfortunately, not all people are wanting to reach out to you for good and to support you in your recovery. The
yeah.
reality is, you know, your old friends are going to come knocking around your door and, you know, maybe your drug dealer. So, you know, really trying to, you know, especially in the beginning, really establish boundaries on who you're connecting with and, you know, maintaining that and really finding a new group that's positive for you and positive for your lifestyle. Because it, you know, it's right there in front of you all the time.
What are some of the other issues that you folks deal with in addition to addiction?
So at Spring Hill, I mean, what we know is that often there's mental health issues that go along with addiction. We are a dual diagnosis program, which means that we support individuals that have mental health issues such as anxiety or depression. And that's very common with individuals that are struggling with substance use disorder. So we're there to support them. Sometimes, you know, what we realize is once all the, you know, the alcoholism or the drug addiction gets stabilized, that's when we can really dig in and look at the mental health side of things. You know, what's going on for this person? Have they always dealt with maybe anxiety or depression? And this was more of a case of, you know, self-medicating. So we really try to look into that. And, you know, another thing that we really look at is the family component. You know, we sort of pride ourselves on a family weekend that we do once a month with the families that are at Spring Hill. And it's fantastic. It gives the families an opportunity to come in on Saturday, get educated, learn about addiction, you know, meet with our medical director, Dr. Sanchez, and understand what's going on for their loved one. We talk about coping strategies with them, as well as, you know, the next day they get back together with their loved one, and then they work on those issues together. I mean, this is a family disease. This is a, you know, a huge family issue. And, you know, we're lucky enough to have other supports. We have the program Learn to Cope come in, which is a fantastic support for anyone that's dealing with a family member that's struggling with addiction. And that support is set up for, you know, for mom, for dad, for the sisters, because they're really impacted. I mean, people stop their lives. It's like a full-time job assisting someone that is struggling with addiction. So, you know, there's just a lot, it impacts a lot of, you know, different people within the family structure.
Are some people predisposed to addictive behavior?
I believe so. You know, genetics does play a huge role in things. You know, what I do know is there are certain patterns that happen. And, you know, most families, you know, if you look at your family history, maybe they didn't really talk about it, but, you know, you think, oh, you know, Uncle Frank, yeah, you know, maybe he had an issue, but no one really talked about it, right?
Right.
So it's, you know, you have to be aware of, you know, what has gone on within your family. You know, you can't deny that it, you know, that it's there. And, you know, even with my children, you know, I say, this runs in your family. It does. It runs in, you know, most people's family. So, you know, being upfront and really being able to sort of talk about it without shame really is a step in the right direction.
Now, you mentioned the and I want to see if I understood this right. You talked about people who suffer from depression or other mental have other mental challenges. Do they are there some types of challenges that because of their nature would draw somebody to self-medicate and then lead to a path of addictive behavior?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we see that all the time. You know, we see, you know, the person that as a young adult, you know, felt anxious, had social anxiety, didn't feel like they fit in, and then maybe began to use alcohol or smoke marijuana to feel more like themselves. They felt more comfortable. You know, it took the edge off. And I think, you know, what we know is that, first of all, when any type of use begins at a younger age, your brain's not fully developed. So what happens is the impact is very different. Your brain's not ready to handle those substances. So, you know, often what we do is we see it snowball, and it's a very slippery slope. It happens very fast, especially when you're dealing with opiates, because the reality is at a certain point, you're having to use opiates again and again, not just to feel high, but to feel okay, to not feel extremely, extremely sick. You know, there's been studies done on the brain where you actually see the difference between a brain that hasn't used opiates and a brain that has used opiates. There's a difference between those two brains, and we know that the time that it takes for that brain to heal can be up to a year, over a year. It's a long process. So, you know, this is beyond just, you know, I feel the need to use. This is biological. You know, this is impacting almost our makeup. So it's tricky.
So Sunspire Health is a national company in the United States, and you have treatment centers in California, Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, South Carolina, Oregon, and Texas. Are any others that I missed? Or?
Nope, that's it.
And how long have you been in business, and what is the volume of people that would access your company, your organization?
Absolutely. So we've been in business a number of years. You know, Spring Hill itself has been around for 4 years. That's our Massachusetts location. And, you know, our capacity there at Spring Hill is for 32 individuals. So, you know, we have a really unique environment. We have an open campus, which is free-flowing, which means, you know, the men live in their housing on the campus. They walk to the dining hall. We have all master's level clinicians, so they, you know, walk to their appointments with their clinicians. They're very structured during the day. You know, people are going out to do equine therapy with staff. We have yoga and meditation. You know, we're really working hard to introduce people to various types of recovery, including the 12 steps. And, you know, again, it's just a unique environment. It's on 70 acres, so it really lends itself to the recovery process. It's very serene up there. It's like its own little world, which is really nice. And, you know, our other locations, you know, I find a lot of times that people in New England and the Massachusetts area aren't always wanting to go out of state. So I'm so lucky that we have this place here in Massachusetts. And then, you know, sometimes we do get the occasional person that says, I need to get out of here. Yeah. I need it. Or the family says, I think this is what's best. Let's send them to a place where they can really just focus on their recovery. And I think, you know, for some people, that's a perfect match. Not to mention, you know, the weather plays a role in that, too.
Sure.
Always nice to be by a palm tree, you know, in recovery.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Certainly lots of information here, and wished we could go a little bit further, but appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule, and we'll post your website on our Facebook page so people who are listening can access your company.
Thank you. That's so wonderful. And please don't hesitate to put up my phone number. I take calls all the time from families. That's what I do. And, you know, I really want to be there to support anyone and everyone, you know, on both the public side and the private side of recovery.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for being a guest. Take care.
Thanks so much for having me.
Right. Bye now.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson 400 Series windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire. The Anderson 400 is attractive, durable, energy efficient, and reasonably priced. Remember, Anderson is the most trusted name in windows. See the Anderson 400 at any of our three locations. That's North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
Gloria Food Store is still Beverly's number one deli, and no matter what New England weather is thrown at us, Gloria is open. With fresh bread delivered from Sunray Bakery every morning, Gloria can provide party platters, calzones, hot trays, cold trays, salad trays, and finger sandwiches for whatever you have planned. Call in your order at 978-922-3613, stop in at 268 Rantoul Street, or visit GloriaFoodStore.com.
People come in, take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. Treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our next guest is an old friend of mine and the former mayor of Salem, but also a worker here in Gloucester government, community development department director and economic development director, Stan Yusevich. Stan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh. Pleasure to be on, and it's good to hear from you.
Yeah, well, you know, you've done a very storied career, done so many different things. I was going through my contacts on LinkedIn. I said, gee, Stan would be great to be on the show. And so it was nice catching up with you the other day. But what's life like out of politics, at least as far as being a candidate? And how does that work?
Well, you know, it takes a while. I mean, I've talked to other mayors that have, left office, and you know, one of them is, of course, our good friend Bruce Tobey. And Bruce always suggested that once you leave the mayor's office, you should go to a halfway house to be reintroduced to society, which there may be some merit to that. But I've enjoyed both sides of the street, if you will. I've clearly enjoyed public service and, was completely fulfilled by my years in it, and I've also enjoyed the private sector and the focus that you're able to create and the accomplishments that you can do outside of government. Both have been very rewarding to me.
You know, I found, having worked in the public sector for 15 years, and when I got out and I was just pursuing private interest, and I ran into Bill Kirk down at the Ben Smith Fieldhouse. I was down for my daughter's basketball game when she was in the Riverdale Rockets, and he asked me what it was like, and I said, you know, it's like taking a backpack off your shoulders to a certain extent. I said, I can come down here, talk to you, say anything I want, and not worry about who's going to call me on it. You know,
yes.
If I want to express my opinion about somebody doing something really foolish or stupid or just, you know, it's not going to come back at me when I go to work on Monday, you know. And and there was a certain freedom that evolved that, you know, you don't necessarily think about. But having said that, what when you look at, and you said something that was interesting to me when you were in Gloucester. You said, you know, in the context of community development, you said part of, I hope I contextually remember this right, but I think what you were saying was something along the lines of part of the service to the business and industry is accommodating the people who are here. It's
right.
Not always just going out and we brought this big company in and these are 46 more jobs and this one has 23 jobs and look at how many jobs we've created. But what are we doing for the people who are here who want to stay here or who have been here for 20 or 30 or 50 years to help them continue to prosper?
Yeah, I actually had the good fortune to write the overall economic development plan back in the early 90s for Gloucester and initiated the process that was used for EDA funds. But in establishing that, or, you know, framing that study, what really had to take place in my mind was, okay, what does the city have to do for retention? How do we keep jobs here? Not just bring them in, but how do we keep what Gloucester has, and then look at the character of the community as a whole and say, you know, what does this represent, and how do we keep that? How do we enhance that? And then how do we sell it? How do we make the outside community understand what Gloucester really is? So you're right. I think what people fail to look at in many cases is taking a true inventory of the assets that you have, and Gloucester has many.
Oh yeah, and it's strangely enough there in the either in the charter or the Book of Ordinances, there's a requirement that, you know, every so many years you're supposed to do an inventory of all your assets and publish that. And it was probably last done when you were here.
Yeah, it is a case of looking at the human and social aspects and counting them legitimately as assets. And of course, you know, some of the liabilities are always going to exist, and that, you know, fortunately there's a connection to, you know, Route 128. Unfortunately, it's at the end of the line.
Yeah.
But you know, and that's always a challenge, but it's a challenge that can be overcome. But everything has to be looked at in an overarching kind of way, and that's what, you know, the plan did, and that's what master planning does as a general rule.
When you look at economic development, in development, community development issues, my sense is that an integral part of that is the education system. Companies want to come to a place where there's a good where their employees, if they reside, are going to receive a really quality education. Do you agree with that? And how much does that play in Gloucester and again in Salem?
Well, I think it plays in just about every community. To a greater or a lesser extent, but if you took a rule of thumb, for instance, and looked at the measurement of student achievement or whatever educational metrics there are, and look at who's high performing, and then balance that or juxtapose that to property values and the rate in which those properties gain value. There's almost a direct correlation, and Gloucester and Salem are very similar in that respect. And they both had very tough times in terms of education. But what it basically has to happen in all communities, in my mind, is that it has to be a commitment to education that then follows economic growth. Because as you know, as we both know, having brought up kids into adulthood, that people want to go and be committed to a community where education is embraced. And I think, you know, both Salem and Gloucester do embrace education, do understand it. But the real pressures are, how do you finance it?
Yeah. What, today at Salem in terms of economic development or the educational system, any observations you'd want to share?
Yeah, I think, Salem has really boomed in the last couple of decades. And the reason that it has is that we've finally recognized that density matters and that population growth is a good thing, provided that it's directed and channeled and controlled. But density matters. And when you look at Salem's downtown, back in the late 60s, early 70s, they created a pedestrian mall, which essentially stopped traffic in the main retail area in the city. And that mall still exists today. So people would say, well, why can't we have a series of restaurants or retail? Why can't that grow as a result of this mall? Well, they kind of had it a little backwards, because what has to happen is that you have to create density. You have to consider the downtown a neighborhood where people, live and clearly have some degree of disposable income. When you place, for instance, as we did in the mid-70s, just affordable housing in the downtown, you don't have the disposable income that sustains retail and that kind of entrepreneurial growth. Gloucester, however, always had the Main Street, both east and west, is really reflective of the town and has a great feel to it and great character. But in Salem's case, density really did matter. And residential use came to take root in Salem, you started to see a growth of that kind of retail.
We had Dr. Elizabeth Bratt on the show a few weeks ago, and
yep.
She brought up, who was a candidate for fellow Rotarian with me, but a candidate for city council, and she brought up the issue of the city becoming a
a gateway city?
No, the immigration. The
A sanctuary city.
Sanctuary city.
Yes.
Thank you. What do you think of that? How big of an issue is that in Salem now? And any thoughts you'd want to share?
Yeah, I to tell you the truth, I think it's an attractive recent issue, clearly. But when you look at the depth of this thing, immigration in this country has sustained its growth for a long time. I'm just second-generation American.
Yep.
And so I understand that the philosophy behind trying to protect people that are here. I don't know that it's as local an issue as many think. And I do think that the presidency or the president and his administration have looked at sanctuary cities in a wrong way. First and foremost, they're coming down on sanctuary cities by fines or penalties. I don't think it's going to hold up in court, to sit, just as a general premise. So, I think Liz has got it right in terms of, you know, understanding the issue. Unfortunately, I think the current national administration has it wrong in terms of how they intend to deal with it.
So we'll leave it to the courts to figure it out, I guess, is what it comes down to. You belong to something called the Workforce...
Investment Board,
and tell us about that and what they do and what your role is there.
Well, I actually chair the Workforce Investment Board Association for the Commonwealth, and it's made up of members from the 16 Workforce Investment Boards throughout the Commonwealth. And those boards are charged with the delivery of services for work, development of the workforce in terms of training, dealing with unemployment issues and career opportunities. So this is primarily a policy-driven organization, at least the association is, where we typically try to move the agenda in terms of financing the programs that are out there, look at new policy initiatives that we may be able to undertake to make the system better and streamlined. And we work very closely with the Secretary of Labor and Workforce Development. It's been a rewarding opportunity for me in terms of staying connected with government and bringing both my experience in government and in business to the table. I've really enjoyed it.
Now you spent some time, and forgive me if I have the chronology wrong, but I think before you were mayor of Salem, were you not involved in the fuel industry?
Yes, I worked for Tennessee Gas Pipeline after I left Gloucester and before I became mayor for a number of years, you know, dealing with project development and local and state permitting throughout the Northeast. Something that, you know, involved having business understand government and having government understand business. So I kind of looked at myself at that in that role as primarily an interpreter of what either side or both sides were saying to one another. I enjoyed that experience quite a bit.
And that was, and that's to the pipeline gas that comes up and connects into the mainland from offshore.
No, it actually some of the work was connected to the system that is driven from the Gulf of Mexico, the pipeline system that comes up to the north, and then one that came from Canada and into Maine and New Hampshire and down into finally terminating at that point in Haverhill, Massachusetts.
Ah, very well, and that's primarily gas.
Yes, it was natural gas.
Natural gas. And do you think that the how much is the gas industry going to contribute to minimizing our dependency on foreign oil?
I think it's a huge bridging device right now, and it's huge only because of the capacity that we have within this continent and within this country. But I think it's a bridge to the next stage of technology, where photovoltaic and wind and you know, other entities, other sources of power can be harnessed. But I think that it allows the country to take an independent position relative to oil that we've never been able to take.
Well, Gloucester's made use of these windmills for energy, and is that something Salem's going to do, or has done, or considered? Or
there was a proposal not too long ago that caused a great deal of controversy, in that the placement of a wind turbine on Winter Island, clearly was not the right location, but Salem's only 8 square miles and does not possess the kind of geography that
Gloucester
communities
does.
Do.
Yeah, yeah. So it
may be limited.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest, and we could talk all day. I was hoping to get to national politics, but we're out of time. But maybe we can have you back.
Oh, I'd love it.
Great,
love
Stan.
It.
Thank you so much for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and we'll be in touch soon.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Stan.
Bye now.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
The Institution for Savings has always believed in giving back to our communities because our communities are such great places to live and work. Last year alone, we donated and pledged more than $3.9 million to local nonprofits, including local hospitals, schools, food pantries, art organizations, and more. Named one of Boston Business Journal's top philanthropic companies, we are proud to be your local hometown bank. InstitutionForSavings.com. Member FDIC, DIF, Equal Housing Lender.
Many aspects of estate planning are interrelated, and you can turn to attorney Bob Madruga for full-service estate planning to help you develop a comprehensive plan in providing for your future. Bob will work with you through the years to adapt your plan as needed, and he can assist you with managing wills, trusts, probate, and taxes. Visit the law offices of Robert J. Madruga at 128 Main Street, Gloucester, or call today for an appointment at 978-283-6883.
NSONewsSports.com is known for connecting North Shore sports fans with local sports newsmakers. Features on teams and players, exclusive video interviews following the big games, live event coverage such as high school football, basketball, hockey, and baseball, live video coverage of the Gloucester Fiesta. MSO also connects you to the area news leaders, mayors, state representatives, state senators, town administrators, city and town elected officials, business leaders, and more. Entertainment features. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at MSO News Sports. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. Leave a voice message anytime, 978-325-3638. Stay connected to your North Shore neighbors by simply clicking on msonewsports.com.
Treat at Sylvan Street, a great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
have to come back and fill in some time here as we are having a problem getting our guest on the line. That happens with live radio. Happens from time to time.
Yeah. Well, it was nice chatting with Stan Yusevich, who, of course, he was involved in Gloucester politics years ago, and it was fun catching up with him on the phone, and always has a lot to offer. We were hoping to get into national politics, but the problem is you get a 20-minute slot, and you have 30 or 35 minutes worth of dialogue, and how to condense that in. But what's going on around town?
Well, actually, glad you asked. MSO Radio will be over at West Parish School in a little while. The Gloucester Police have a new initiative that'll be kicking off today. It's called Kids and Cops, and it will be taking place the very first episode or method or meeting or whatever it's going to be called. We'll start today at West Parish at about 11:30, 11:40. It won't be live, but the mayor will be there, Mayor Sefarthio Romeo Taken. And if you haven't listened, she's got an interview up on that we did on Wednesday that has to do with recent things going on at the Fuller School property that are very interesting. And then there's actually an article in the paper today sort of countering what the mayor was hoping for. So be sure to check out the interview with Mayor Sefarthio Romeo Taken. But she'll be at the West Parish School. Dr. Richard Sapphire will be there. He's the superintendent of schools in Gloucester, as you well know. And Police Chief John McCarthy will be there. And I do believe that Officer Detective Jeremiah Nicastro will be there, too. And I think Jeremiah is the main prime mover in this thing and getting it going. So we will have some interviews over there. Good Lord willing, the creek don't rise and Trump doesn't put his finger on the magic button, we'll be okay.
Well, the
and by the way, when I said that little Trump thing, you know, you can guess what my feelings are in national politics.
Well, yeah, I mean, John McCarthy is we still haven't scheduled a time, but we're hoping to have him on Trending Now next Friday and chat with him, a former classmate, Gloucester High School class of 1976.
Well, I believe he was appointed the assistant police chief when Chief Campanella was the man in charge a year or so ago. Wasn't he the first assistant chief?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That Gloucester has had, and then now Chief McCarthy, I guess he's an interim chief, but I'm pretty, well, I think most residents are expecting him to be the chief permanently, if that's not already been done.
Yeah, I think well, he's the acting chief until they are given clearance from the state and federal government to proceed with the FAME nationwide search. But I think people are happy with John. I mean, he's doing a good job. He's a cop's cop. He came up through the ranks. He's been on the police force for 37 years. Started out of the police boat. And he's a good guy, and I think people like him. I know people like him, and he works hard at his job. He's a big supporter of the department and the troops, and you can defame nationwide search, but you know you still you know there's a lot of good people here.
Oh yeah, well it's funny you should mention that. Also, I've seen Dr. Christine McGrath recently. And she and Dr. Mel Patterson, two favorites of mine when they were in the Gloucester school system. You know both of them very well. And
they could have been the superintendent,
well,
assistant superintendent.
That's what I was getting.
Yep.
The school committee, and it's, I'm going to put this in quotes, infinite wisdom, went elsewhere. And that has no reflection on the people who were chosen. But Dr. McGrath, Dr. Patterson are two of the most accomplished educators in this state, probably in the history of education in this state.
Well, Swackler put together a hell of a team, and they were, it happens. You'll see this in not just here in Gloucester, but other places too, is the notion of an insider versus an outsider. And you get people in a policy position who look at things and say, we need someone from outside to come in and shake things up, or we need someone to run it like a business. And it becomes that. And with superintendents, I found, at least when I was in educational administration, you either got somebody who was a leader whose background was in education and curriculum and so forth, or somebody who was the nuts and bolts person. And that set the direction of where things were going to go. There was English in Black wrote a book about school administration, and they make reference to the term legend of the chairs, and said that historically the path to the superintendency was you were a history teacher, an assistant football coach, and then you might have been the history department leader, and then you went up to be the assistant superintendent, and then the superintendent. And he said, you know, in any other industry, that doesn't fly. If you played that to the medical profession, it would be like you were the scrub nurse, you were the janitor, the scrub nurse, and then the lead surgeon before you were president of the hospital.
Yeah, but see, there are businesses or entities that lend themselves to that, and I can't think of any other more apropos than education, except possibly one, and I want to go back to General Omar Bradley. You know, by that standard, Omar Bradley would never have become general of the Army, a five-star general, one of the greatest leaders in the history of the country. And so, you know, I see where you're going with that, is that people get too stuck, I think, too often into a template, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, let's see what we have right here. And so what if this person did grow up from a custodian to become the principal? I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, I'm not saying.
No, I know you are. Yeah, I know where you're going. That's what I'm saying. I'm following. I'm agreeing with you 100%. And it's like, but some people get stuck in that. Oh, you know, he's a bus driver. He can't know much. Excuse me. You know.
Well, there was a time in Gloucester where the people who were elected, and they weren't all natives, and there's no requirement that you be a native. Although up until Bob French came, we had never had a mayor that wasn't a native. But there was a period of time where the thinking was, well, if they came from the Gloucester school system, they're not good enough to lead it. And that just really cast such negativism.
Well, I don't know thinking was that. I think that was the thinking of those who perhaps were sitting on the school committee.
That's exactly what I mean.
And you have, what, seven parents generally who have an agenda.
Yeah.
And so if your kid didn't have great success under certain circumstances, then you were going to look to take care of your kid, believing, and I think people who are on school committee have their hearts in the right place. This is not a knock. But they're believing that, okay, if I get my kid the help that I want the way I want it, that's going to help all kids. And we all know that doesn't work that way.
What I found, having been in educational administration, and it was I've used this in teaching school finance and school administrative classes at college level, is to watch the bias of or the potential bias of school board members who have children in the system, and watch the bias change with the grade level of their children. So if your kids are in the elementary level, maybe they're getting a little bit more support than they might otherwise. When the kids get to the middle school, we got to really help the middle school. They need help. And when they get to the high school, well, the middle school has everything. That's and you see how that flows, and it's
and it drops off when you get to the high school.
It's
as though the kids their careers end at eighth grade, and that was so frustrating to me as a teacher, was that all the help, if you will, and I'm not going to get into initiatives because I think there were just too damn many of them, and I think there still are. But the help, the infrastructure help for the most part, as well as aides and stuff like that, were bunched into the middle school or the middle school concept year after year after year in my experience, and it all stopped right there. And the kids would go to the middle school, they had the best of everything, and they get to the high school and they'd look around and say, what is this?
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa. So, you know, it's not a business, and it's not a fine-tuned machine. It's an art, and I think teaching is an art, and I think that selecting superintendents, you do the best you can, and school committees are.
And it's a function of what's out there that year. I mean, you have a turnover, and sometimes you hit it right, and there's a lot of really qualified people that are looking, and people coming up through the ranks. Harry Webster made the observation once. She said, "I'd rather have somebody who was on their way up than somebody who was on their way down."
Well, we got a lot of on the way downs.
Yeah,
we got a lot of them.
You get people who are.
Christine and Mal at that time were on the way up.
On the way up,
but we got a lot on the way down. I got to interrupt you. I just want to finish my thought because it sounds like I'm criticizing school committees. Not what I mean to do. School committees, there is a bias, and it's a proper bias. Parents get on the school committee because they care, and that is not a bad thing. And in my experience, most school committee members who are not political climbers wanting to go on to city council and then to mayors. But the others, the school committee members who live there and stay there, have their hearts in the right places. Hold on. Let me just get out of here. Go ahead.
We have our third guest, Genevieve Knave, and we're going to have you come back, but we'll start out, and maybe we can have you back next week or the following week.
Okay.
So you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do with you're the founder of the Center for Therapy and Healing.
I am, yes, which is why I missed your call. I'm so sorry. I was had a little psychotherapy emergency with someone, but I am the founder of the Center for Therapy and Healing. We provide psychotherapy for trauma recovery, addiction recovery. We do family work, really using the expressive arts. We provide yoga in the community, and we do wellness events in the community as well.
And where is this, and how do people contact you?
So it's in South Boston. We have two spaces, and they're right next door to each other. One is a therapy office. The other is a movement studio. And to get in touch with me, the best way is definitely email. And my email address is really easy. It's gnave@therapywithjen.org. And so therapy with Jen, the Jen is with a G.
Great. We've got 2 minutes left, and then we have to go. But we hope that you would be a guest maybe next week if your Friday is scheduled. If we can clear some time in your schedule.
Absolutely.
Great. And tell us a little bit. You do dance. You're a dance movement therapist. Was what your BA was in?
That's what my BA is in neuroscience, and my master's is in dance movement therapy, yep. So that's one of the expressive arts therapies, and it's really just an alternative way to express yourself other than using just words. So I do traditional talk therapy, but I try to really involve the body in the healing process. So our center tries to get people into that through, you know, yoga, through sports, and then eventually really using the body to express and get into the creative process, because we just know so much about how trauma is stored in the body, that the body is really key to recovery. And obviously with addiction, the body is a big part of that too.
So the people
leave it out is hard.
The people who would come to see you are people who may be have substance abuse disorders or PTSD or
Those are two big ones.
OCD.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
Okay. Great. Well, I'm getting the music that says we have to go, but I'll arrange with you to be on either next week or the following week.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I apologize for missing your first call. Have a good day.
Take care.
Thank you, bud.
Yeah, definitely line her up for first guest next week if you can.
Yeah.
Because I want to follow up about how you get from neuroscience to dance therapy, and I know there's a connection. So I hate to rush. Ordinarily, I'd let you go long, but I've got to get out of here and get over to the West Parish.
Yeah, and the first guest, when I told her about the third guest, she was fascinated, so they'll probably end up connecting.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we'll look forward to that next week. That's Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposk. I'm Rick Moore. Have a great weekend.